Well, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to see everybody out on such an awful morning outside weather-wise. It's a pleasure to be able to welcome Steve and Peggy here to talk a little bit about the program that they've gotten started on really greening China and working collaboratively. And if you read the bios, I won't go through the bios and the introductions because I think they've been passed out, but I think the thing you will see for both Steve and Peggy is they come at this from a real entrepreneurial perspective. And so they're trying to get something started that gets real projects moving forward, creates the momentum, gets work going, which is in contrast to a lot of the other programs, which are more top-down basis. And that's why we thought it would be really quite useful to get the presentation about the work that's going on, the successes they're having. I don't know exactly what you're going to say, so I don't want to frame it too much. Successes they're having, and also the obstacles, and really give this a bit more ground-level perspective on the issues. And then what does it mean for jobs, I think, here in the U.S. as well over time? So if we can just take a second, I thought it might be useful to take just a quick run around the table to have people identify themselves, and we can kind of know the different groups that are represented here. I'm David Pumphrey. I'm the Deputy Director for the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. And want to start here, Tobin?
I'm Energy. My name.
Terrific. Thank you. I'm very pleased to have such a diverse group. It's really a lot of different Washington institutions represented here. So, Steve, do you want to kick the discussion off?
Yeah, thanks, David. I don't know if we need the microphone, but I guess we'll use it since we have it here. Thanks, David and CSIS, for hosting us this morning and, being entrepreneurially minded, as you mentioned. I think it's important to be able to have a round table on a square table, because that's kind of the nature of the issues that we're talking about is trying to manage very, very large scale issues that are probably most difficult to manage when you're addressing them in a traditional, conventional manner. And I think sometimes doing that in a using unconventional wisdom is often the best approach. So, again, I'm Steve Papermaster, and I will introduce you again to Peggy Liu. And we are involved with and founded JUCCE, J-U-C-C-E. That is the Joint U.S. China Cooperation on Clean Energy. It's a not-for-profit organization that we founded just about 24 months ago. How many hours was it, Peggy?
I think 23 months.
I think, yeah.
3 hours.
I know, I'm exaggerating a little. We got a few more hours to go to make it a full 2 years. And the past 2 years have been really all about exactly what the name suggests, which is Joint U.S.-China Cooperation in Clean Energy. It's about the greening of China. It's about relationships between the United States and China, public, private sector coming together in a very pragmatic, action-oriented way. And it's really about speed and execution. So a brief background on that. I am a longtime entrepreneur and business person in science and technology based in the U.S., been involved with different businesses that are very global in nature with some fair amount of exposure to China over the years as well. Peggy's a longtime entrepreneur and investor as well from the United States, but relocated herself and her family to Shanghai a few years ago, and we came together a couple of years ago for a major forum, MIT Energy Forum, and some related events that were really focused on the very issues of how to deal with the monumental, scalable, and urgent issues of every combination of energy requirements, rapid scale growth, and related environmental issues in China, and how the United States from both a government standpoint as well as a private industry standpoint could come together and try and find some dramatic solutions. The last two terms under the Bush administration, I've chaired the Energy Committee for PCAS, which is the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, which is a part of the Executive Office of the President, now working closely with the incoming Obama team on a lot of transition issues and managing a lot of the programs that we've established over the last several years as well, and confident that those will be put together in a nice, organized fashion. But briefly, the formation of JUICE came out of our discussions and meetings in the spring of 2007 and some predecessor work prior to that. But JUICE is really a story of bringing concept to reality very rapidly. And this was really born out of work that Peggy and I and a number of others did in the spring of 2007. And as we really focused on the scale and timing urgency of the issues, also resolved that we knew as important as government-to-government relationships are, they also come with shackles from a protocol standpoint and expectations and a lot of trappings, important but still, trappings which can be real impediments, even despite good, lofty, well-meaning goals and intentions. And also knowing that even more from a U.S. standpoint, that when you take on initiatives like this, if you take them on solely as government programs, especially in U.S. out of the federal government, you have changes in administrations that happen, and you have changes in personnel, and you have changes in philosophies and commitments from time to time. And so, it becomes difficult sometimes to plan with certainty people's time and commitments and energy and the ability to really trust that programs that are launched will be sustainable. So, for example, the Asia-Pacific Partnership, which is an important set of programs that Department of State and others have been involved with and have a lot of merit, are all at the same time our programs that are launched under the auspices of one administration and, you know, dealing with counterparts in China and other regions in Asia. It is difficult to say with certainty exactly what happens to those programs over time. So just to recap, what I'm sure everyone in this room knows, or you probably wouldn't be here, is that China is dealing with an industrialization and urbanization, electrification, and anything else that you can add an ION to the end from an English standpoint, at a very compressed rate. And so it's a steep curve to climb. The resources required are enormous, financial capital, intellectual capital, emotional capital, and when that all comes to bear in terms of energy in China, you're dealing with just intense levels of scale. The country is spending over $30 billion a year just into its electric power industry in terms of infrastructure. The need to provide electric power and all other forms of energy usage from an industrial, commercial, residential standpoint is amazing, which also means that all the mistakes that you can make when you're putting infrastructure together, you can make those mistakes on a really large scale very, very quickly, and it means you have a lot more to clean up in the aftermath. Now, the United States was also very good at doing really smart things and really dumb things. It just did them over a longer period of time. So you take all those smart and dumb things and compress them, and again, the stakes get higher. So just what we did with JUICE was launch an organization that we really believe could be a key catalyst, an organization that is action-oriented, that it really acts as a catalytic network for pulling together government resources and private industry resources, entrepreneurs, investors, private equity, venture capital, and focus on a relatively small number of very, very large-scale requirements in China, and those mainly having to do with the need for electric power and all the infrastructure that goes along with that, the construction, architecture, design, and construction of the tremendous amount of building that has and will continue to go on in China, and all the related energy and environmental implications that go with that as well, and then a few other areas, all of which are very large, but if it's even possible to describe, you know, if it's possible to narrow down such large scale issues into a few reasonably focused initiatives in the grand scheme of things, that really has been our goal. The other goal with JUICE is to sunset the organization. This is not an organization that has been set up to try and live in perpetuity. The goal is actually to have the organization have no real need to exist, you know, in a reasonable period of time, not like 100 years, hopefully something around 10 years or so. And Peggy says she can't do this much longer than a few more years anyway at the current pace. So JUICE has launched in the spring of 2007. We've had a few major events over the last 2 years that we can describe in a little further detail. But on a day-in and day-out basis, we've got a few key programs and a remarkable team led on a day-to-day basis by Peggy out of Shanghai, and a core team that we've assembled that has now spawned a amazing set of programs, including a mayoral training program that we'll describe in a little more detail, including a blueprint for clean energy and a blueprint for smart grid in China, working with a number of different related Chinese government agencies that are going to be familiar to many of you here, in working with them to go introduce concept, work the concepts into requirements, and begin to resource those, again, in a very, very short order. So I will stop there for a minute. That gives you a little bit of background. I want to turn this over to Peggy to help fill in some of the color commentary on this. And we've had a lot of fun. It's been a tremendous amount of work. But JUICE is, I think, a very profoundly impacting organization whose reach and scale belies its short tenure in the last 2 years. Peggy?
Thanks, Steve. That was a great introduction of JUICE. What I'd like to do is spend the first part of my talk talking a little bit about how U.S. can create jobs and commerce while constructively engaging China. So as both David and Steve talked about, we're a very practical organization, very entrepreneurial organization. We believe in public-private partnership. And I think that with the coming of the Obama administration, there's a lot of hope that we can do things faster, with a very productive path lies ahead of us. And so today what I want to do is focus on three items. One is the smart grid. The second one is urbanization of China. And the third one is really vocational training for green jobs. So the idea is that in taking a look at the market levers in China, the things that are really creating the largest usage of energy and what we need to fix in terms of energy systems so that we can really change the way China creates and uses energy, there's some very, very obvious things, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with them. Urbanization, we have approximately 50,000 new skyscrapers coming online in the next 20 years. 350 million people will be moving into urban cities over the same time period. Rob Watson, the father of LEED, says that we build two New York cities in new floor space every year. Okay. So tremendous inevitable urbanization. What this is the largest market in the world for building materials, for experts on urban planning, for people who know how to do water treatment systems, municipal level waste treatment. In terms of another trend, the electrical grid, as Steve said, we are electrifying China as fast as possible. And in 2007, we spent $35 billion in new power grid construction, and $18 billion of that was spent internationally. So these are a couple of the major market levers that we've been focused on, and we believe that this presents a very unique opportunity in the next 5 years, or within the next 5 years, for the U.S. to constructively engage China on climate change issues, but in a very tangible, practical, constructive way. So let me start out with smart grid. Smart grid, when we first started bringing in people like Steve and Diane Grunick from the California Public Utilities Commission and so on to China to talk about what smart grid is and what the benefits might be to China, we were frankly met with a lot of blank type stares. The context is in the last 4 to 5 years, they've been very, very focused on ultra-high voltage transmission lines. So just to give you an idea of how fast China moves, in December 2004, they proposed, the state grid proposed ultra-high voltage transmission lines. Today, we have 645 kilometers of AC lines already implemented, and they're working their way up to 2,000 kilometers of DC lines very shortly. So now they are open to looking at what smart grid is. And for those of you who are also thinking about what is smart grid, the way that I like to describe it very simply is if an alien had come in to the Earth in 1985 and said, please build the internet from scratch. This is sort of, the internet for the electrical grid system, everything from power generation to transmission to distribution to end use to things like the, laundry machine in the electric vehicle. The smart grid today, if we can get the state grid and the southern grid, there's only two grid companies in China, by the way. One of them covers 88% of the landmass. Okay, this is the largest utility in the world. There's a handful of people at the state grid that are looking at new technologies. So think about that for a second when you're trying to push smart grid boxes, when you're trying to push smart grid software, services, efficiency. There's only a handful of people in China that you need to enable in order to create tremendous change. As opposed to, there's over 3,200 utilities here in the U.S. There's a lot of land use, state border type issues here that we have to get over in order to solve or to really demonstrate smart grid in a meaningful way here in the U.S. Whereas in China, again, once they have a successful demonstration project, the goal is then to roll it out nationwide. And you can do that when you have an oligopoly, right? So what we are doing with the Juice China Smart Grid Cooperative is seeking international experts to come in to the cooperative and come to Beijing, come to Shanghai, like David Moeller, the CTO of Duke Energy, did in November, or the president of GridPoint, Peter Corsell, IBM, GE, Siemens, Current, Kima, Quanta, Nexent, Cisco now. Many of these people coming to the doorstep, right, of the decision makers and jointly exploring what smart grid is. Now, the opportunity here hopefully is obvious for the U.S. companies, right, whether it's creating smart grid jobs here in the U.S., R&D jobs, sales jobs, people who can figure out demonstration projects in China, help deploy in China, tremendous opportunity for commerce. Now, Duke Energy, the reason why they launched this, helped us launch this initiative at the Clinton Global Initiative in September of last year with Jim Rogers, the reason why they're interested in this is because they see that they can learn from the deployments in China faster than they can learn from what's happening in the U.S. And if China makes one big buy, the production costs, the economies of scale, right, production costs go down, purchasing costs go down, everybody benefits. So the smart grid is a tremendous opportunity right now, today, for U.S. companies to get a seat at the table, so to speak, right, and to showcase the best-in-class products and experts that we have from the U.S. and make long-term friends with the people who are deciding the future of the electrical grid in China. So we are in the process of organizing our second large smart grid forum, May 26th and 27th, in Shanghai this time. And the goal is to work alongside the state grid with the Shanghai Municipal Power, with East China Power Grid, who are our co-sponsors, and try and figure out what does smart grid look like for China? How do we roll this out into a demonstration project in Shanghai and then roll it out from there? So this is the first point that I'd like for you to sort of think about, the tremendous opportunity that lies in China as a marketplace for U.S. people to tap into. The second one, as I mentioned, is urbanization. So in China, mayors of 683 official cities, and McKinsey estimates there's probably more like 800-plus real cities, this is a tremendous opportunity for U.S. companies, whether it's master planners.
When Peggy says real cities, you know, you have to have 10 million people.
At least a million people, right? I mean, there's 1.33 billion people divided by 683. I mean, there's a lot of people per city on average. And, you know, the urbanization report that McKinsey put out estimates that we're going to have 12 or more hub-and-spoke cities of 30 million people at least, okay? The city that I live in today has 20 million people, Shanghai. So urbanization is inevitable. They are seeking help so that they can be the eco-city of China, right? So these mayors are now starting to compete with each other. Everybody is supposedly building an eco-city, right? And but, you know, the reality is that we are lacking in capability to really deploy. And when I say capability, I mean people like AirUp Master Planners, to people like XPV and Water, to Covanta and Waste to Energy, but also down to the people who are installing insulation and the waterproof membrane behind the insulation, right? So China is right now open arms, right, to people coming to China, whether it's train the trainers or people who are selling boxes, building materials, or people who are selling solutions, financial investments. Right. So what we've done at JUICE is create something called the JUICE China Mayoral Training Program. This is done in conjunction with the Mayoral Training Center in Beijing, which is run, it has been run over the last 20 years by two ministries, the Ministry of Construction, now called the Ministry of Housing and Urban Rural Development, and the Ministry of Organization. And so what this is a compulsory training for 30 days, sometimes 7 days at a time, for mayors, vice mayors, and they're also including SOEs, heads of SOEs. So if you want to think about implementation in China, it's really these people who have an amazing amount of control over land use locally, policy locally, financial systems, consumer advocacy, citizenship advocacy. So these are the people that we want to enable as fast as possible. We want China to be able to leapfrog past this sort of steaming train, right, this amazingly fast train that's called urbanization. We want to enable them so they can do energy smart cities, right? And so what we're doing is we're doing a combination of case studies, Harvard Business School-like case studies, of what other cities have done already in the past, successful stories, and bring them in Chinese to the courses, but also bringing a list of vendors that can actually deploy this locally, right? So what we're trying to do is drive deployment, not just educate in a lecture-type format, in a theoretical or academic way. We also want to enable them with financial resources. So we're going to be covering what traditional financing resources they have, as well as alternative financing resources, because a lot of these mayors might not have heard of GEF, or CER, or VER, or IFC Chewy, or ADB, or, you know, name all the alphabets and mix them up, you know. So what we're doing is creating turnkey solutions and enabling what we call buyers of green solutions. Right? So the mayoral training program that we've set up is win-win. It's a perfect public-private win-win situation, where the mayors, the vice mayors, the heads of SOEs get to tap into the best experts, the best products from around the world. But for U.S. companies, it's essentially a very unique sales channel to the heart of China that would take years and an army of people to engage these types of relationships. The third message that I'd like to share with you today is really about vocational training for green jobs. And so you've probably heard a lot about green jobs and creating this marketplace in the U.S. for the U.S. What I'd like to sort of put on the table today is why not coordinate with China, right, from the very beginning? Let's create Green DeVries or Green University of Phoenixes, right, vocational training institutes, where we're coordinating with the companies on the ground in China who need to hire these people. Let's coordinate with the Chinese government, right, and educate people here in the U.S. that can be deployed locally in the U.S., but also tap into this amazing, phenomenal market known as China. Right? We are hiring or can hire thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, especially when it comes to train the trainers. Right? So I like to tell the story, you know, if we were to give every single person today a free solar panel in China, we still would have a hard time deploying that, because we don't have the shipping logistics infrastructure. We don't have designers that know how to design these solar panel systems. We don't have electricians. We don't have roofers, right, all the contractors. We don't have the maintenance folks. So these are people that we need to build from scratch in an awful hurry, in an almost, unbelievable pace, right? So we're welcoming expertise internationally. So I think that the U.S., especially people like the Department of Labor or the Department of Energy who are thinking about how to create green jobs, you know, let's talk about creating jobs here in the U.S. to export internationally. So those are the three messages that I'd like to sort of lay on the ground. I guess I should finish the green jobs message with sort of an introduction to something that McKinsey is helping us doing for our Merrill Training Center. They recently launched a China carbon cost curve report called the China Green Revolution, looking at 200 clean tech sectors over the last 3 years. And what we'd like to do is take each of those sectors, or at least the major ones, and say what are all the green jobs that are necessary to create those products, design, deploy, operate, maintain those products, and then to say what types of skill sets are necessary to fill those jobs. So there's right now 20 to 30 million migrant workers out of a job in China. There's about 7 million college students, fresh college grads, that are out of a job. So you can sort of divide into three buckets: migrant workers, college grads, or something that really requires a lot more specific expertise. Right? So one of the things that we want to do is to lay the ground for what it is that we're talking about when we talk about a curriculum, a vocational training curriculum for these green jobs. So that's a little bit about the three ways that we think the U.S. should be thinking about engaging with China. And that involves policymaking, that involves private sector, that involves NGOs, thinking about these three buckets. These are very tangible areas that we can immediately show results. And JUICE is already focused on this and already well on its way to executing these programs. So we invite you to join us. So I'll briefly talk about some of our other programs that we're thinking about in China. We're based in Shanghai, Beijing, and San Francisco right now. Some of our executives come from, for example, the lighting program that we're working on. The lead is the former general manager of GE's Asia-Pacific Lamps Group. And he joined us in order to create a CDM program, so carbon credit program, for end-use energy efficiency, where we could distribute 10 million compact fluorescent light bulbs in exchange for 10 million incandescents. But bring the message, bring these light bulbs to student campuses, starting with Shanghai, and create a curriculum, an energy savings curriculum, that would create future champions of green. And this curriculum would then be incorporated into regular yearly curriculum. So this is something that we've been working on for over a year now. It started out with creating a new deemed savings methodology that was written by largely by Anna Keat-Niederberger of Policy Solutions, one of our advisors in this program. That was sort of the foundation for how we can finance this program. Right now we're hopefully going to close financing for this, and if we do, we will go and execute this program in the next 7 months. On very short order. And the idea is that if this model works, we can then go from city to city and do the same thing. So 10 million compact fluorescent light bulbs, just so you have some idea, is about 2.9 million tons of carbon dioxide. It's about 600,000 students and teachers that will be educated in this program. So it's a very large program. We also do other types of consumer advocacy programs. We're trying to launch something called the Green Hero Mobile Campaign. In China, we have no voicemail. So we rely completely on SMS. Email is very secondary. And so it has become a really great channel to reach out to consumers. So we're trying to combine the SMS channel, text messaging channel, with an American Idol type of rating, you know, game. So Steve will get a text message saying, "Steve, how were you a green hero today? Right? What did you do to save the environment or save energy today?" And they'll be rating on the web and on WAP. And the people who win will get their name on, you know, a consumer item, like a soda bottle or something like that. And so this is sort of the types of – the reason why I bring this one up, although it hasn't been launched yet, is because it shows you how we're looking at energy in a very innovative way. Trying to bring in people like M-Info, who did the WAP site for the Beijing Olympics but has nothing to do with energy, try to bring in, you know, soda bottle – type companies who, you know, don't have much to do with energy, but they all want to participate.
Well, it's also a way to we want to take advantage of, again, we want speed and we want results, and part of that is harnessing the social networking and harnessing the cultural traits that are very prevalent and the communication method. So this is a way to make. Again, it's a massive education program, but make it fun, make it cool, and make it something that especially the younger generation can relate to and really take ownership of. And it's these are very powerful concepts when you bring them into an action-oriented program.
And by the way, it's very cost-effective, right? So our programmatic formula really starts with, as I said earlier, looking at the major market levers like industry use is 70% of our energy, urbanization, the grid, et cetera, consumers, what's happening there, figuring out who the key decision makers are in those areas. And as I said earlier with a smart grid, in many cases there's only a handful of people that you really need to enable to make great change in China. And then what we try to do is partner with local channels like the Merrill Training Center, like the state grid and the local utilities that can help us get reach across China to the right places. And what we do is we view these people as buyers of green solutions, and Juice is a system integrator of the best in class from around the world. We also stress an economic viability to our programs. So the private sector participation is very crucial. We believe that we have to be able to show that we are helping them make green while going green in order for us our programs to be sustainable, right? And again, Steve said we want to sunset ourselves. So a lot of these programs are designed for private sectors to take over at a certain point. So all of our programs are meant to have three-year milestones or less, which is sort of difficult in the energy sector when you're talking about infrastructure. So we're really focused on capability building to a very specific set of people. We're very, very focused in the types of programs that we're working on. So with that, maybe we should open up for a little bit of interactive discussion.
Great. Okay. Yeah. I think we're small enough. It's kind of broad.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty broad question. My personal thought is if you look at the consumer spending in China. Mm-hmm. People are very, very thrifty. And I think that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. I actually don't think it's a good thing to be pressuring people to consume more. That's just my personal thought. I think that's completely misguided. most of the fiscal stimulus package is on infrastructure. So, for example, $100 billion is being allocated to utility infrastructure. A lot of this is because most of China is not electrified yet. There's a Go West program. And so if you look at the map of China, most people live on the coast, on the east coast, right? But, you know, actually there's a huge amount of land on the west. So I think what's happening is that many of the programs, like dams and roads and things like that, are just being accelerated. So they might have been on the books already, but they're being accelerated because of the fiscal stimulus package. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think that's the right choice. I think that's the right direction. The Chinese government is very, very smart, and they think very long term. And I hope they don't, you know, succumb to outside pressure to have people buy more, you know, Louis Vuitton bags and and such, right, just in order to increase consumer spending.
Yeah. Well, at the consumer level, David, you're right, there's a lot of elements at consumer level. So it's a relevant, it's a very important issue. But there's a consumer level of infrastructure as well that has to go in. And so when you look at the, and a lot of that's indirect. So, for example, an individual there may not be the one planning some of the basic things that they are themselves going to use other than cars, which are obviously an important category. But the construction, again, going back to what we're doing and have talked and worked extensively in the mayoral training program, the residential, commercial, and industrial construction going on is happening at such a pace that has a huge consumer impact from an infrastructure standpoint. What are the design constructs, materials, and efficiency of all the different homes and multi-family dwellings that are being ramped up very, very quickly, as well as from an industrial commercial side where people work, where all the manufacturing is done, all the plants, et cetera. And so that, as well as then the electric, the smart grid element. And these things have a, these have such a disproportionate impact on the energy equation everywhere, but certainly in China during this massive infrastructure ramp-up period of time. And then I think in waves, you know, it's not like it's decades away, but a few years away, there'll be an even bigger consumer level where you, as you begin to populate more of these, more of the new construction with refrigerators, appliances, et cetera, then it's a bad thing to put a bunch of inefficient refrigerators out there. It's even worse to have even very efficient refrigerators tapped into a very inefficient grid, because then you have no way to really use the intelligence that you want to build into the network and even to the appliances. It, again, it's kind of like having a fabulous computer device and no internet to connect it to.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
I'd like to ask you about the choices you're making.
So two of our programs focus on this slightly indirectly. I think that a lot of the efficiency gains can be reaped on the operation, the design of the plant, and then the operations of the plant. And so this ties back to the vocational training that we need, local capability building, or things like auditors, right? So there's a whole slew of people that I think need to be put in place before we can design very efficient plants, operate them, audit them, enforce it, right? Monitor, measure, etc. So indirectly, we're approaching that problem. The other program that I didn't mention earlier is the Juice Energy Blueprint website that we're developing. And this, because Juice is a small organization, we can't possibly work on every single bit of the energy spectrum. But what we can do is enable key stakeholders in the energy sector to be more productive, to figure out how to make better energy choices, to collaborate more efficiently internationally as well as cross-sector. So what we've realized is that the energy sector is very siloed. It's very opaque, especially when you look at China, largely because it's a different language, because the culture is different, the way the relationships are built is slightly different. It's very far away. So, you know, the other thing with the energy sector is that there's new statistics all the time. So today, China has 10 gigawatts of installed wind capacity, whereas, you know, a few years ago, we started from zero, right? So statistics are sort of changing every single second in China. There's new people, there's new companies, there's new technologies, there's new policies that most people in the West don't know China has actually implemented in the last year and a half. And they haven't really spent a lot of time doing positive PR for themselves. And so it's very opaque. So what we've decided to do is create a Web 2.0 platform called the Blueprint, which will give a framework to all of this information. So one approach is to put a wiki up, so everybody can just post everything about anything. But that, I think, is very hard for any one person to keep on top of and have any type of meaningful insight. And so what we're doing is we're creating a series of matrices for each, one matrix for each topic, like solar in China, as an example. And this matrix is a very simple matrix, 4x4, 5x5 matrix, with barriers to progress in that particular sector. For example, in solar, the cost per kilowatt hour is too high. We have a lack of utility-scale energy storage, lack of smart grid, lack of energy workforce, you know, policies, pricing policies. In the other axis, it would be market-transforming goals. You know, so in China right now, 90 to 95% of our PV panels made in China are exported outside of China. If the China is actually going to be able to implement 25 by 25, which they want to do, 25% of our energy mix from renewables by 2025, very ambitious goal. You know, they're going to have to deploy a lot more inside of China. They're going to have to reverse the ratio, in fact, right? So as an example, that would be a matrix, and then inside this matrix would be programs that people are working on. And so in this way, we can easily, everything's Web 2.0, so you can rate programs, you can rate people, you can rate policies, statistics, companies, et cetera. So with using the collective wisdom of the masses, meaning every single person in this room today can have a voice, right, and help people, decision makers, say, these are the programs that are most effective. These are the people that are the biggest influencers. These are the companies that we should be investing in. These are the technologies that will really be panaceas, so to speak. So we should be putting the world's resources behind these few programs, right? Right now it's very, very hard for any group to compare apples to apples. And so, I mean, just look at, for the people in Washington, D.C., I should make it relevant, for the people who are doing RFPs, right? The RFP process is usually a handful of people and consultants that are looking at an overwhelming number of RFPs, and how can you possibly tell, you know, which ones really deserve the money, especially with billions of dollars going into the fiscal stimulus package. In a very, very short period of time, they have to put that money out. You know, with a platform like this, you can get somebody in, you know, somewhere in Arizona, somewhere in Hammersby, Sweden, who are experts in coal-fired power plants, telling you this is a program that deserves attention, right? So the first part of this blueprint is insight. The second part is then using collaborative tools like a dating site, Match.com, right? So now these programs can put up job listings and say, hey, I need money, or I need government relations, or I need experts like the father of LEED, Rob Watson, to come and help me look at this green building. But a lot of these people haven't been networked, right? And it is, again, a very sort of closed community, the energy sector. But it's rapidly growing. So how do we connect all these people as quickly as possible?
And just to tie that back to the coal issue, which is a big issue. I mean, and very similar to the United States, we've got, you know, over 200-year domestic supply of coal. It's a dominant domestic energy source for power production, and that's true in China as well. So the fact that the majority of the power plants are coal-fired is not going to change anytime soon. And they are not all going to suddenly get the most state-of-the-art scrubbers. We're not going to suddenly have advanced carbon sequestration in every one of these plants. That technology is not even fully perfected or tested, even in the U.S. or in other markets. So going back to the education issue, the reason it has such a big impact is that When you have on a net basis 1 to 2 new coal-fired power plants being brought, you know, up live every week or two, And even at the same time as some older ones are being decommissioned fairly rapidly, basic techniques can have an enormous impact. The pre-washing of the coal, the transportation of the coal, the mining of the coal, the co-location of some of the coal resources, the ability to add in relatively lower cost technology, higher recapture elements for combined heat and power. These are things that can be done without as great an expense with a lot of, you know, largely training knowledge, and that can be disseminated very quickly. So, you know, when you look at the power equation in total, coal-fired or otherwise, and back to the reason why efficiency is so important, and this is true in the U.S. as well, is that, you know, if I take this glass of water, if I take that pitcher over there and start pouring it and say, well, I'm just going to keep pouring water into this glass, how long will it take to fill it up? Well, it fills it up at one rate if this glass is intact. If there's a lot of holes in this glass, in this cup, right, if I'm losing 40 to 50% of the water while I pour it in, it's going to take a lot more water at a much faster rate. And that's what happens. It's simply the basics of especially power. You're losing 10 to 50% over the power lines. You're losing 30 to 40% just at the plant level. So you can accomplish the equivalent of shrinking 30 to 40% of the coal used by making it more efficient at the plant level in the first place. Yes.
Hi. I'd like to ask two sort of different questions. First is following up on this gentleman's talk about coal. I wondered where you draw the line on green, and that's an issue that many of us deal with.
Kind of right between blue and yellow.
No. I'm working with China right now on natural gas issues, and so I was wondering whether your organization would be something that would promote natural gas usage in China, and might be interested in some of our programs that we have going on from the Department of Energy related to natural gas. I'll be in Beijing in May helping teach a natural gas and LNG training class, which is TDA sponsored.
What have you identified from a scale standpoint and a sourcing standpoint for natural gas in your work there?
The Chinese government is very interested in sourcing from outside of China as well as...
Well, they have to. There's not a lot. Yeah, there's not much work with there.
And they're building pipelines at a rapid rate right now to bring natural gas in from elsewhere. By the way, I just read something. This is back to the coal issue. I just read something. China, with the amazing coal resources, is currently negotiating to buy coal from Australia.
They're already an importer of coal.
Well, it's also, and that's right, not just because of the capacity required, but there's different grades of coal, of course. And the ability to get higher grades of coal that burn a lot more cleanly with a higher intensity level.
Mm-hmm. Back to natural gas.
Yeah, back to natural gas. We don't have a natural gas program. Our programs aren't necessarily focused on a particular technology, but rather a system, right? So what we would want to do is use the blueprint to be able to create insights or to elevate insights in the natural gas sector so that people can work on those particular issues. So, for example, for natural gas, one of the things that we could do is have more industrial uses of natural gas versus mm-hmm. residential use like we have in Shanghai, right? So, you know, how do you actually make that change as cities, as mayors are building new cities at a rapid pace? So how do you get that concept? What's the most efficient way to use the limited natural gas resource that we have available in China? So those would be the things that we would focus on, we don't have a natural gas program per se.
Okay. And the second question is, building on your discussion of training programs and train the trainer programs, it seems as if most of what you're discussing really is more on the educational and training side rather than equipment manufacturing or licensing, which then has those issues related to intellectual property rights, et cetera, which are always an issue. I was wondering if you would reflect on what you think is the focus almost solely on the training and train-the-trainer efforts rather than equipment and
Well, the equipment issues are, of course, equipment and infrastructure, all the components and products are huge issues. And China's a large market, intellectual property rights and the issue of protection or lack thereof is obviously a very big issue. At the same time, there's the products that are required, ranging from the computer technology, turbine technology, software and machinery, are ones where it's not that we're disinterested in that. We're working with a lot of manufacturers. Matter of fact, a lot of major U.S. companies, GE, IBM, Cisco, and on down the list, are working closely with us, and they are individually and collectively, of course, focused on their own IP protection. At the same time, what we've seen in the energy initiatives in China is that one big part of the education is on IP. I mean, it's not a core part of our program, but it's an ancillary part. And so it's raising that awareness is important because there's a great desire for technology transfer, technology usage. And along with that, that a lot of these U.S.-based companies and other international companies are doing a lot of their manufacturing in China as well. So it's not going to get solved overnight, as you know. But the education element is still key because what we're doing is highlighting the impact of the issue on the rate of progress in China. So the IP issue is an inhibitor for a lot of companies, right? And so as we've worked with a lot of the agencies in China, raising that issue, is one more wave that they're seeing is highlighting how and why there needs to be changes. And there, in the last year and a half, 2 years, there has been a lot of change. There's still a long way to go.
They have a new IPR law that they're working on. But, I think a lot of people come to China with IPR concerns, but, I think there's an easier way to address China from a U.S. company perspective. I think that China, it's very hard to compete. Ultimately, it's going to be very hard to compete just on price and just on features, especially with commoditized products. What China is really lacking is sort of the services, the soft part, right? How do you design a system? How do you create a solution? How do you operate? How do you create post-sale services, right? So I think where IP isn't involved and it's a lot easier to sell into the Chinese market is if you're offering a total solution, right? Whether it's pumps and motors or insulation, et cetera. I think if you enter China, don't try to just figure out how to get over the IPR issue. Try to create a better mousetrap.
Well, the other key is that, said another way, that a given component, if it's easily replaceable, is an easier target. If it's an integral part of a systemic solution, an integrated solution, it's much more difficult to carve out. There's a lot more interdependencies and integrated components and integration points.
It's a software and services type model, right? So you're selling software, but you're really making a lot of money on the services. Right. And there's pre- and post-sale services. Yes?
I've been reading Julian Wong's book since Mutual.
Are you from the Center for... Where are you from?
I just returned from Oxford.
Oh, okay.
But you probably mentioned the role of the U.S. as companies selling things into the Chinese market. If you're thinking about pushing that a little further, what kind of intermediaries would you think?
System integrators. So there's a huge vacuum for organizations like JUICE. Now, JUICE is an NGO, so we're a little bit more of a neutral intermediary, a neutral convener, but what we essentially are is a system integrator, right? So last year, David Bohigian, who used to be the Assistant Secretary for Department of Commerce, he did a few clean tech delegations to China, and I participated in part of one of the last ones. And I noticed that there was like one air filtration company, one coal company, one this company. And I was like, you know, I think it makes more sense if you just bring all of the best-in-class U.S. companies that are all focused on coal. And you say, here's the value chain of how do you design a coal-fired power plant, create it, operate it, et cetera, right? How do you do procurement for it? And then you create a whole solution that, and then they can understand it. They can say, oh, okay, well, now, there's only one person that I need to work with is the system integrator, right? And I get it. I get how this affects my entire ecosystem versus this is a widget, and I have no idea where it, you know, how it compares to other widgets, how it really affects the ecosystem in comparison to other parts, other widgets in other parts of the ecosystem. So I think there's a huge opportunity for system integrators, to use the, you know, a very salesy term.
Landon's been very patient,
okay.
So Landon,
okay.
Just focusing on the green job aspect, how to create green jobs in the U.S. As a policy person, that's what I'm focused on right now. And the jobs that you have described so far seem very temporary and very short-term. And as we're looking at 7 to 8 million jobs created as green, I cannot imagine system integrators or trainer, or to be a long-term thing, especially since China, the Chinese are very intelligent people, can learn, adapt, and then recreate the entire thing themselves, even on the service side, not just the manufacturing. So my question is, you know, how far out are you doing the job? The job that you're looking at, you're saying these are green jobs.
It's the whole value chain.
Yeah, I don't see a distinction between the education that we're doing now for our workforce as engineers, as software engineers, as mechanical engineers or whatnot. The difference between what they're doing now and what would be a green engineer or a green software designer. So,
well, I think on the jobs front, of course, I mean, part of this is just aiming smart folks at different problems. So what's the difference? The difference is the problem we're working on. It doesn't mean necessarily that the job is different per se, although some jobs are different. And I think the issue has to sort itself out. It's not as cut and dried as, you know, here's U.S. Workers that can literally go to China and perform work on a, you know, over a period of time. How many of these are U.S. workers? How many of these are Chinese workers? They'll have to sort itself out. I think that the main thing is that there's a sustainable, very scalable amount of work to do. And whether it's U.S. firms investing at hiring and training Chinese workers as well as using U.S. workers, you know, I think that's a typical mix that companies have to sort out for themselves on supply of labor, overall cost, and best usage of resources, and how many of that, you know, how much of that is domestic within China, labor sources there under Chinese owned or managed companies or joint ventures, how many of the U.S. or other international. That's going to have to sort itself out. My perspective is highlighting the kinds of jobs that really have fundamentally different attributes to them, where you have needs that are, you've got a tremendous disparity between skill base and need. So, for example, if you take a look at what it takes to design, build, construct, maintain, and manage, you know, hundreds of thousands of kilometers of a electric power transmission, which is using not only the high voltage lines, but under a smart grid, you've got very different skill bases there, right? And so those skills are going to be needed short term and long term. By the way, those are the same skills that are needed in U.S. and in other regions of the world, everywhere that's going to be going through any type of electronic metering to smart grid transformation. So you're going to say, well, we used to have sort of the equivalent of linemen or people who are working to construct and maintain the basic lines. You now have a whole new element of skills that go along with that, a lot more electronics than just, you know, pure transmission materials. So there's a whole set of job categories and skill categories that will need, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of people on a just in U.S. and China alone for the next 20 or 30, you know, plus years, that you've got a very, very small pool that exists today. So yeah. in studying that, what I would suggest is trying to decompose the kinds of skills that are required in each of these major categories. And you're right, some of those are short-term, but I think a very high percentage of these are fundamentally changing the nature of the work and very new skills.
I mean, there's two trends. Remember, urbanization is happening at a rapid rate at large scale over the next 20 years, and it's not going to stop there. That's just productions for the next 20 years. So there's going to be continual need to train a huge group of workers that know how to deploy these green cities. So that's one trend. The other trend is that if you look at the energy sector, it's like the Internet, where there's new technologies and best practices happening all the time. And so you're going to continually need this type of recertification of these workers. So I think education, just focusing on train the trainers alone, is a huge market, right? And then we deploy faster in China. So you can actually come to China and do sort of like exchange programs, right, where the U.S. workers learn on the ground in China and then come back to the U.S. once, you know, things are happening in the U.S. with smart grid, for example, and, you know, they've already been trained on many, many sites, right? So I think that the first part of your question, wow, I mean, there's no end in sight for green jobs. I mean, there's just none. So, you know, again, the people who are building skyscrapers in China are literally the migrant workers who are coming in, and they don't know how to properly do the waterproof membranes behind insulation, and that completely almost negates the effectivity of insulation, right? So somebody needs to come in and train these people. Auditing of buildings, right? Baseline measurement of energy, mapping out energy resources, right? So it's just like a gazillion number.
All of these coming in and training them, once they understand how to maintain it and do it themselves. I'm looking at U.S. jobs in general.
Yeah, but, you know, again, technology is changing rapidly, so you continually need retraining.
But you know what? I'd go back and highlight. It's not so much. I think it's a misperception to think it's just about how do you take these jobs to do the work in China. These are new jobs that are going to be created sustainably, and they've got to be done in the U.S. as well. We have every bit as much. We actually have more transformation because a lot of this is new infrastructure in China. It's a redo here, right? And you know, we've got a 50 to 70 year old grid that we are about, you know, we are very early on in. So I think a fundamental issue on the green jobs issue, this is partly a China issue, partly just a U.S. domestic issue, is what are those green jobs and where and how will they be deployed, and, you know, which ones of those are sustainable versus temporary or transient. But I would go back to something we talked about a few minutes ago. There is a substantial amount of infrastructure work that is going to be going on in the United States, very similar to China. And there's a lot to be gained by viewing job categories and skills categories as being very much the same, whether they're done in China or the U.S. So it's, to me, it's less so much what jobs will be created for U.S. workers that they will go and do in China, and what jobs will be created, period, that have to be done for work that has to be done both in the U.S. and China.
I was in Shanghai just about a month ago, and I was extremely impressed with a number of things that were going on. For one, the maglev train that I took from downtown Shanghai to the airport. I thought that was unbelievable.
Are you over your whiplash? Are you okay now?
I am, yeah. It doesn't stay at that high rate of speed for very long because the distance is just, you know, not that long. But I'd like to kind of raise a question about what you said about you only have a small group of influentials to you know, reach in order to do something. I gave a couple of lectures when I was in Shanghai, one at Fudan and the other at East China Institute. And there were a lot of, you know, students there. I asked my host, excuse me, what are these fellows going to do when they graduate? And he said a lot of them are going to go into business. Some of them are going to go into postgraduate work and so on. It seems to me that if you convince the urban planners in Shanghai, that doesn't necessarily translate to another city. That each city's, you know, problems and scale of problems are almost unique. Shanghai may be comparable to Beijing, but it's not necessarily comparable to Shenzhen.
And that's exactly why our mayoral training center relationship is so key, so that we can scale this coursework. Once we have a database of all these case studies, it will be available to all these mayors, not just in the courses, but also online. Right, and so and then we partner with vendors that can actually act locally. So if they're interested in a particular case study or a solution, they can call a vendor the next day and say, can you come and help us do a feasibility study locally? Mm-hmm. So I think there's a combination of things that need to happen, but you're right. It's, you have to work with local distribution channels that reach multiple of these decision makers across China.
Right.
So we don't try to do anything that's a pilot project in a particular city. We really focus on scalability, replicability. So a lot of people ask, well, did you do anything with the Beijing Olympics, or are you doing anything with the Shanghai Expo? And honestly, those are all one-off events. So it's very hard to replicate those types of unique environments.
Mm-hmm. Question about changing the incentives for local leaders to invest in green technology. You talked about their training programs, their mayoral training programs, which would seem to increase their knowledge and their sort of green consciousness as well. But the I know the central government has been thinking about what they can do as well. And in 2007, I believe it was, they passed a national energy conservancy law.
An amendment.
Oh, an amendment. Okay. Could you
So the last year and a half in China's history has been a tremendous tipping point. China in the last year and a half has become one of the most progressive countries when it comes to energy policy. It's just that a lot of people don't know about it. Okay, there's not a massive PR campaign coming from China saying, look at all the great things we're doing. They're just really focused on the doing of it. One of the things that happened was the 11th five-year plan. This is, you know, the five-year period ending in 2010. They said that 20% energy intensity reduction per unit GDP, 10% emissions reductions in certain emissions needs to happen within 5 years. That's a tremendous, tremendous target. Some people have called it overly ambitious when you're talking about absolute numbers, right? The Energy Conservation Amendment that you are referring to states that not only will China pursue energy conservation in parallel with economic growth, but according to our advisor, one of the top environmental lawyers, they actually say this will be pursued in priority. Energy conservation will take a priority. More importantly, they've said that local heads of state will be held accountable to these targets. And, for example, the water pollution law also says the heads of enterprises are going to be held accountable. And secondarily, they say systems will be put into place so that you can measure how well you're doing. Now, that being said, China is an incredibly ambitious country. They really want to be the best that they can be. Did I just steal that from, like, U.S. Army or something? but, you know, so they're very smart. They understand that energy is, you know, we have an energy crisis. Energy independence, climate change, is, you know, they understand these things. So they're very proactively in the central government laying down these very interesting targets. But, again, it all comes back to education at the local level. How do you actually implement What kind of systems are you actually using to measure the emissions that are happening from a city or a building? How can you actually get a baseline? So the Ministry of Construction, or MOHRD now, recently just finished a 18-city review of baseline energy in different types of mixed-use buildings, right? So, but this is sort of precedent-setting. From a baseline, then you can tell how well you're doing. But these are all sort of capabilities that we need to build in China from scratch, right? And then you need to go back and audit, and you know, there's a lot of stuff to be done to, in order to reach these targets. China today is not the China of yesterday. I think a lot of people in the West still view China as sort of Tiananmen Square or a bunch of people in a room with, I don't know, red bandanas or something like that, right? But the China of today, literally the block that I just moved onto didn't exist 8 months ago, right? For those of you who know Shanghai, Maominglu and Wujianglu, it's this eating pedestrian street that got totally razed and now is this like amazing hotspot like Santana Row in San Jose, right? So, you know, in July, they banned all free thin plastic bags nationwide. Boom. The next day, no more. I have to now, you know, bring my little, you know, IKEA bag or, like, you know, the plastic bag to go shopping or pay for it, right? So there's tremendous intention. The State of the Union, the equivalent of the State of the Union, you know, they had the word energy, I think, over 300 times. Right, as you can sort of compare and contrast with other countries there. It's all about implementation. That's why JUICE is really about deploying currently available technologies and trying to implement two current policies. Because if we were just to do that, we'd actually be most of the way there. Right?
Did you have another question?
I have one, just a real practical question. Under urbanization, you say you provide a list of providers. I'm just curious, what have you listed, and more to the point, what do you need to list? You know, are there more types of providers?
I'm sorry, for which program?
Well, under urbanization.
Which providers to list?
Yeah, I'm just saying, are there vendors, other sorts of needs you would kind of like to get companies visible?
Well, I mean, everything. So from financing, we're doing a finance module with McKinsey again to take a look at, you know, who are the different types of people operating on a municipal level, whether it's ESCOs or GEF or IFC Chewy or carbon credits, et cetera. So financing is definitely one area. Urban planners, right? So there's not enough AirUps and MVVs and Owens Cornings operating on the ground. And then even if you have an eco-city plan, there's a lot of eco-city plans actually in China, some of the most amazing eco-city plans, but how do you actually get them implemented, right? There's a little bit of a lack of capability and financing there. So, you know, you know, again, everything. If you take a look at transportation, if you take a look at buildings, electrification, I mean, just across the board, we need to do it. Everything that ends in, was it T-I-O-N?
That's it.
This is sort of a fairly large general question, but I was tweeting some of what you guys were talking about.
Oh, great.
And I had people coming back to me.
Patty's my tweeter friend. Twitter friend.
This is great. Yeah. This may be the first CSIS program that's been tweeted.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if I did a great job, but I'm working on it. But people were coming back to me saying, but their office buildings, you know, sort of empty in Beijing, and Shanghai's office market is getting pummeled. How this all being about the issue of implementation, how is the global economic slowdown impacting that? Because you just actually said some local areas are having trouble getting financing. So
the real estate market has been hit hard, yeah. Right? I think China will rebound a lot faster than anywhere else in the world, but it's being hit pretty hard. So, for example, in Xintiandi in Shanghai, there's these two very strange-looking kidney. I can't even describe what these buildings look like, but they're two 5- and 6-star hotels, like the Dubai company, you know. Anyways, I mean, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a 6-star hotel until I saw this building. But, you know, they're just sitting there because they ran out of money, you know, and it's because a lot of people are doing these sort of massive showcases that, you know, aren't really practical.
Well, the question, maybe I should refine it a little bit. What I mean is how it's going to affect the how how the global economic slowdown will affect things happening on the local level. The reason I thought of the question was just because people were saying that things are slowing down in Beijing, things are slowing down in Shanghai.
Yeah.
How can they even be talking about these rates of urbanization when things are clearly coming?
Not to minimize the issue, but I mean, as we've gone through in different economic cycles here in the U.S., even a very, very severe situation, the real estate is generally longer term projects. And while you can end up with a situation where a building is half built or, you know, really gets completely stranded from a financing standpoint, most of the time projects get completed if they sit there empty for a while. Not good from economics of the project owners, but in the grand scheme of things, it'll get absorbed. And so the bigger question from an energy efficient standpoint is how are those buildings constructed? How are they constructed so that they are durable and sustainable, and that you don't have to go back and do are you cutting corners because of the financing? Cutting out some of the most important infrastructure components in and between the buildings? But I think from a capacity absorption standpoint, it's an important one, but it's one that generally takes care of itself over time.
And generally for businesses, there's no better time. I'm sure you've heard this before, but there's no better time to go green, right? Green is about being lean and mean and energy efficient and saving costs and productivity going up, et cetera. So if you define green that way and not between blue and yellow, you know, there's no better time. So, I mean, that's one of the things that we're working on, not as a major program, but just as a key influencer in the market. We're doing small roundtables with VP of sustainabilities, you know, from a Cisco to a Coke to a Hayworth, et cetera. They don't have to be energy companies to go green internally and save a lot of money. That's why the Merrill Training Center, by training, 50 people at a time, half of them are heads of SOEs like Baow Steel, you know, we can have tremendous influence on telling them, look, if you were worried about, not thinking about going green now, hey, this is the time, right? Going green is about making no left turns and saving gas. Reference to FedEx. Yeah. Yes?
At one point you talked earlier about setting kind of goals that were 3 years at a time, and then you think about sunsetting the program. At what point do you determine that you've met those goals and want something self-sustaining?
Well, as an example, our Blueprint website. I think that once we get over the initial hump and have a lot of people working on it, it has become the center of international collaboration. You can make a self-sustaining entity with, ads, right, with premium data services. With the smart grid, ideally, after 3 years, we will have had a demonstration project hopefully completed. Right, and then you can start measuring the results, and then the state grid really should be carrying the banner by then, right? We're here to sort of kick up the momentum to bring all the players to the right table, at the same table, to identify, in some cases it's creating the market, and sometimes it's expanding the market. The Green Hero Mobile campaign, it's very clear that MInfo, our mobile WAP partner, they can go ahead and run with this once we have the initial first-year program up and running. It should be like a Got Milk campaign, right? Mm-hmm. They can go for, I don't know, how many years now? 10, 20, right? So from the very beginning, we design in the thought that our partners that we're selecting should be good enough to then take it on. In the Merrill training, somebody like an ICF who helps, for example, the EPA design the Energy Star system, they can then go locally, right, and work with the mayors, the cities, on building efficiency and industrial efficiency. Right, so we have that thought in the back of our head all the time when we design these programs.
Okay, we're running close to the end, yeah. So I think I see a couple questions. So how many questions do we have? So I see one, two, so that'll be it. So why don't you, but make them quick.
Okay, quickly, this is great for China. Do we have a similar program by the PCAST or any kind of mechanisms like that to implement such things in the U.S.?
Well, I think in there's a lot of programs in the U.S., maybe too many in some ways. I think I think there's the issue of having any kind of a central central program. A, is there one purely from the government? There's a lot of programs out of Department of Energy. There's programs at state level, local level, but I don't know that there's one central program. And, you know, it may be one for, again, for something that's outside of government to do. I'm sure there's plenty of opportunity for that in the U.S. as well.
You mentioned targeting the buyers of green solutions and sort of pulling together the best that provide those green solutions. And I was wondering if Juice worked at all with local entrepreneurs in China for providing green solutions.
So, you know, we certainly invite people like SunTech, you know, Trina, those types of people to participate in our programs. So yes, but you know the value that the Chinese side, especially the government side, has seen in Juice is really a window to international experts and products, right? Making it digestible in Chinese language, bringing them to the doorstep, to people in China, their doorstep, so they don't have to go abroad to find them, to scour the international resources for the best of the best, to be a little bit of a filter. So while we do, of course, incorporate Chinese companies, that's the Chinese side doesn't necessarily see that as our main value.
We're also working closely with a lot of the venture capital organizations, funding organizations that inevitably the majority of the entrepreneurs are networked into. Mm-hmm. And we've actually both held and participated in different investment forums as well in China.
Yeah, if you come to our Juice China Energy Forum, you'll see it's pretty much half-half. There's a lot of, you know, the idea is international cooperation, right, to get peers together, share best practices.
Well, I want to thank you, Steve and Peggy, very much for coming. I think this is a great program you've got going. The kind of entrepreneurial outlook is terrific. It's probably not seen as much in Washington, so, yeah, there may be a bit of a language barrier between people who work in Washington and where you're coming from, but I think it's great, and I think that wish you the best of success. Why don't you join me in thanking them for their.
Thank you very much to CSIS and David.
Oh, okay. No, it's our pleasure. Believe me.